We're back with On Second Thought from GPB. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is the Vienna Boys Choir. The choir is made up of sopranos and altos aged 9 to 14, founded more than 500 years ago. It is one of the best-known boys' choirs in the world. The group is also notable for embracing singers who are going through puberty, a time when many boys quit singing because they have so little control over their changing voices and are subject to singing notes that don't quite fit. Now the Vienna Boys Choir has organized a team of researchers to equip choral teachers with the information and skills they need to keep adolescent boys actively involved in singing. Georgia State University music professor Patrick Freer is part of that team and joins me now in the studio. Hello, Patrick.
Good morning.
So did you grow up singing?
Well, for a time. I was an active singer in a rural part of Western New York where I grew up, sang every time there was music class, and then went away to summer camp one year, came back. My voice was doing something unusual. My teacher asked me to stand in the back row of the choir and mouth the words since I couldn't sing anymore. I'm 5 feet tall. Standing in the back row was not an option, nor was mouthing the words. My parents did a good thing. They took me to piano lessons, which kept me in music. And then it was many years later that I became interested in what had happened and what we can possibly do about it to assist teachers.
So you quit singing?
I did.
That must have been a big loss.
It was, because that was what I was good at, and I wasn't good at anything that involved other kids, like sports or whatever, at the time. So I didn't have a social group, and the research shows no matter where you are in the world, boys join activities for as much for the social activity as for anything else.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just a loss of a personal hobby or passion. It's a loss of a whole group.
It is, too. And my initial entree to teaching when I, in a first-year teacher, I was a high school teacher with a very large high school population and a very small choir. So I decided to tackle that by starting a community choir. And the first people who came were senior citizen women. Well, okay, that's fine. And after a while, I realized that accompanying them were their husbands, mm-hmm. who sat in the back row and didn't sing. And one day, I decided to ask why, and every single one of them had been told, as a junior high boy, not to sing.
Oh.
And so we immediately rethought the mission of the choir and did voice lessons and music teaching lessons and all of that sort of thing, and brought them into the choir. And one of my great joys is to know that many of them are singing, or at least continue to sing, when they went to senior citizen homes with their wives, which was important to them. We need to stop thinking of singing as a one-off kind of experience and something that is that can last across a lifetime in a variety of settings.
So we know that boys' voices change when they're going through puberty. Can you explain the mechanics, exactly what is happening?
Well, it's very detailed, and that's kind of the confusion for teachers, is how much detail do we need to know? And I think the answer is enough to be able to work with the voice. So you can certainly go into the anatomy and physiology, but basically there are 6 stages of the boys changing voice. Research shows that all boys go through them. And as those stages progress, as influenced by hormones and all of that sort of thing, the voice gradually lowers and then gains some different characteristics, such as the high voice notes, which initially were there as a boy, young boy, come back about halfway through as this falsetto thing that is the high voice that adult men have. But the reason it's called falsetto is because it feels like you're doing absolutely nothing. So the boys feel like they sometimes can't trust it if they don't have a teacher who knows the process. And more importantly, teaches the boys about the process so that they can follow it. After all, it is their voice. And that's where science can help us.
Yeah, I want to talk about that process. But you are now a university professor. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you taught middle school and high school. Let's listen to a performance that you conducted. This is a male middle school choir. So we hear a wide range of voices there. How challenging was it to keep these older, a little bit lower voiced male students involved?
It comes down to the choice of repertoire. Sometimes teachers are afraid to choose repertoire that accommodates all of the boys' stages of voice change because, A, it's going to have more parts.
What was that, like a South African piece or something?
That was, mm-hmm. Yes. And then the repertoire, sometimes we won't have as many boys on different voice parts, depending on where they are in change. So we have to sometimes adjust to the boys rather than choose the repertoire and have that sound inside our head of what we want it to be. We have to think of what's the experience like for the kid. And then does the piece of music allow for the boy to change parts as his voice changes, even though we're using the same piece of music?
Uh-huh. Because we think of the traditional boys' choir as this almost angelic, you know, young... innocent, for lack of a better word, I think is part of the way that people think about the repertoire. So, as you said, you know, that you have some challenges to keep the boys involved. But how challenging was it for you as a teacher to incorporate these changing voices of kids who did continue singing?
Well, I'd like to back up to something you just mentioned, which was this conception of what a boy singer is. And we don't only have that conception. That conception is conveyed to the boys. So when we have, say, a third grade boy or so who has a wonderful soprano voice, and we say, your voice is wonderful, you have a wonderful voice, what we're doing is we're uniting the voice with the boy rather than saying what the boy can do with that instrument and that those skills will remain. So what I'm finding as I now travel the world and talk with boys about the voice change to find out what they've experienced, there's a profound sense of loss for many of these boys who were built up as young boy sopranos with no guidance as to what the transferability of those skills would be later.
Yeah, and I wonder if there's also this association with growing up is bad, right? Growing into a male, a man is negative.
Yeah, we often think that boys uniformly want to be quote unquote men. And that is not necessarily true when you talk to middle school boys. I think we have that conception as older people looking backward, but I don't always get that sense from the younger boys. Mm-hmm. So it's more multifaceted than I think we give it credit for.
So how about your colleagues? What kind of things did you hear in professional circles about why boys stop singing?
Well, when I started, it was boys stop singing because they don't like chorus, they don't like school music, they don't like to sing. Well, my interviews, I've now done interviews with boys in about 20 different countries, uniformly says that's not true. Boys do like to sing. The problem is that they don't like how they're required to sing in choir sometimes. It's not even so much that they don't like the repertoire. They recognize that the repertoire is what it is and has to accommodate different voices. What they do want to learn is skills. They do want to learn vocal technique. And that when they withdraw from singing, they often will go to other activities that take advantage of the boy's growing body and new capabilities. And that very often is athletics. Mm-hmm. And so there's the misconception that boys drop out of choir to go to athletics because they like sports better. What they tell me is they like the instruction better because coaches give specific instruction about how to get better, what to do, what to practice, and tomorrow we'll come back and I'm going to give you feedback on that.
Yeah.
And we need more of that.
That's
in singing.
What they want. They want that kind of interaction. And I think there's also this association that singing is feminine or unmanly.
Boys don't say that. What they do say is that it is the style of teaching that potentially is off-putting, and that over time, remember, boys only know what they know, and they only know in their community, in their school, so it really is up to the teacher. That's another thing that the research is showing, that an individual teacher can only control or have influence on what that individual teacher can have influence on. And so it's important to create that worldview in the situation that you're in. We can't, teachers will often say, boys think, say, singing is feminine or whatever. Whether you think that's a bad thing or not, we can't change the world. What we can change is our school. our situation.
Patrick Freer is with us. He's a Georgia State University music professor. He's been working with boys' choirs around the world as a part of a team of academics and researchers to try and help boys continue singing even after their voices change. But let's talk more about around the world. Last fall, you worked with the Vienna Boys' Choir in Austria. This year, you've been to Madrid, Ecuador, Sweden, around the U.S. So how about the differences in cultural attitudes observed between these respective countries and their attitudes towards changing male voices?
Yeah, I get that question all the time. And in fact, that was my question when this all started a few years ago. I would say there's not as much difference as you might think. The differences tend to be very specific. For instance, in Greece, where there is not music in public schools the way we have it here, there will be music schools where music is a big portion of the day along with the other academics. In those situations, the boys will uniformly say, oh, we don't like choir, we don't, you know, whatever. And then, but they all sing, and they sing in this thing called Byzantine choir, which is, you know, there's not the separation of church and state that there is here. But so Byzantine choir is all melody and a drone, which is one or two notes, sung by a man, led by a man, always loud, boisterous singing. So they don't have to read music. So they don't view that as being how we stereotypically view choral singing. You know, in Europe, there's an organization of choral directors called Europa Cantat, and they're actually considering changing their name away from this formalized style to group singing in any format, which could include what we're talking about here, could include other things as well, because there's now this sense that people sing together as groups for a variety of reasons, only one of which might be the concert performance with which we're most familiar.
When you were in Austria, you did work with Gerald Wirth, if I'm saying his name,
Wirth,
mm-hmm. The conductor of the Vienna Boys Choir, very much responsible for the choir's inclusive approach. What makes his method so successful? Is it technique? Is it how they think about it? Is it sort of the psychology of it?
I think it's all of those, and part of this project is to perhaps codify a little bit of that. But it comes back to this philosophy of who's more important, the repertoire or what is more important, the repertoire or the singers. And he's talked about changing his philosophy away from the choir exists to perform repertoire toward repertoire exists to serve singers. I experienced this when I was a college student at Westminster Choir College in Princeton, New Jersey, way back when. And at the time, the American Boy Choir was just down the street. And while I was a student, the American Boy Choir director changed his philosophy. So no longer would boys have to leave upon voice change. Instead, they would leave when they turned age 14. So that the choir had to change with the boys rather than the boys having to leave when their voice started to change. Well, and that was a big philosophy advance, I would say.
Well, let's listen to a clip of the Vienna Boys Choir. Here they are singing Pharrell's Happy. So clearly the repertoire has changed. But are there, I mean, historically, higher voices considered so much more valuable than lower? The Vienna Boys Choir, this stalwart organization that presented this tradition over and over again. So are there traditionalists who feel like, why are you doing Pharrell songs?
Well, that's not all they do.
Of course.
And certainly. I think there are some, but I would say that perhaps those traditionalists are a little bit limited in what they're talking about. Remember, we're talking here about music education for all boys and singing for all boys, and that there will be different kinds of boys with different kinds of interests and abilities that call for different kinds of musical experiences, just like in sports. You have your elite teams that represent the school, but that's just a fraction of the number of boys and girls in that school. But that doesn't mean that no one else has anything to do with being physical or athletic. It's just that that team only has 12 players.
Well, you are working with a range of choirs, you know, from the ultra prestigious mm-hmm. to those that are passion-driven in small schools across the U.S. But with budget cuts, many schools' art programs have disappeared. Can you talk about some of the other challenges music teachers face in today's education landscape?
I think the budget is one, but singing is a good thing because it requires, dare I say, less money than, say, if you were outfitting a band or an orchestra where you have to purchase and maintain instruments. There's that. There's the new focus or awareness of transgender singers and transgender students in general, which then is a new area of focus for many teachers. That's a challenge. But I do think that the world has changed in the sense that there's so much communication available to everyone that we no longer have the isolation that we used to have. I used to hear that from teachers early on in my career, that they just felt like no one cared, no one knew what they did, and they didn't have resources. That's changed. Mm. In the U.S., it's not true in most other countries. We are very fortunate in that we have an education industry that supports us with publications and repertoire and materials and all of that. That's not the case elsewhere.
Well, such a pleasure speaking with you. So interesting. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Georgia State University Professor Patrick Freer. Now, just ahead, school is out and pools and beaches are open for the summer. We're going to hear from a nonprofit leader who wants everyone to swim safely. And she wants those safe swim tips to reach all kids. Stay with us for more of On Second Thought.